not call them names, but you know, in that old 19th century and 18th century, you know, gentlemanly manner, that where they just like read you to filth, but they do it so eloquently that you can't do anything but laugh at it.
Welcome to the Off-Grid Outpost podcast, where we discuss the journey to real liberty through self-sufficiency, counter-economics, non-aggression, and the agora. The Outpost represents the border between societal norm and the pioneer spirit. Every episode contains practical, philosophical, and technical information you can use to gain the freedom you deserve. Welcome, everybody, to the Off-Grid Outpost podcast. I'm Cyrus. And today is another bonus episode, so it's just me. Regina's not here. I am having a conversation with Blake Roeder. He's an agorist and an entrepreneur. He owns and operates his own dance studio. He has a YouTube channel called Individualist TV. And he puts out a lot of great content about a lot of common topics in the anarchy, agorism space, individualism. But he always seems to come at things from a not-so-common angle, which I really enjoy. So highly recommend you checking out his YouTube channel. He's kind of a Spooner fanboy like I am, so I wanted to have him on so we could just kind of have a discussion, and that's what this is. We talk about Spooner and some of his writings, his political positions. We touch on the exclusivity of we the people. We talk about the idea that the current American government is really just kind of a rebrand of monarchy, and some other interesting ideas. So here we go. Hey, Blake, how are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm really good. Blake Roeder. Did I pronounce that right?
You did.
Okay, good. Okay. It's got that funny little mark over the O, and I don't have any idea what that means.
Well, that's called an umlaut, and it's a German name, which is technically in German pronounced Roeder. And that's my original family name that was changed on the way over here. So really in America, it's R-O-E, but I spell it with the umlaut because I like to honor the original spelling.
Gotcha. Interesting. Yeah, I'll never get that German pronunciation right. So
it's all good.
Roeder it is.
Roeder works for me.
Okay. So you've got a YouTube channel called The Individualist.
Yes.
Or not The Individualist. It's called Individualist without the.
Yes.
Right?
We may add a .tv on that to make it easier to search, but I'm working on it. But yes, Individualist wanted it to be minimal. So it's kind of a minimal concept.
Right, right. And I'm going to put a link in the show notes. You've got a lot of great videos. I highly recommend them to the listeners. And I'm going to put a link in the show notes to make it easy to find. Because when I typed in individualists, there were 10 others. So
yes.
I don't want people to get confused, go to the wrong channel. So I'll make sure and put a link in there. That doesn't even include the ones that were named The Individualist. So,
right.
You know.
Yeah, that's why I'm going to put a .tv so it's the same as my website. So that might make it easier for people.
Yeah, that'll be good. Some continuity there. Yeah, so I wanted to have you on and just kind of have a discussion about Lysander Spooner and some of the ideas he talked about. We were kind of talking earlier, and you had mentioned that when you talk about Lysander Spooner, it really doesn't matter what you talk about. Libertarians love him, which is true. And
yes.
It's also kind of funny that every hyphenated anarchist wants to claim him also. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah. Well, he had different phases in his writings and opinions, and I think that, you know, different wings of the anarcho-dash world claim him at different times in his life for their own purposes. But I think that the libertarians win. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. He did go through kind of a transformation. I mean, he was writing from like age 25 until he died. And he was in his late 70s, I think, when he died. So, you know, nobody's the same at age 25 as they are at age 70 or anywhere in between. So,
yeah, it makes
sense. It's really kind of neat to watch all of his or read his writings and kind of see how he moves over time, you know.
Well, I think that it's important that people do change over time. You know, I think that sometimes mm-hmm. when we look at politicians, for example, which we don't like politicians, but you know, mm-hmm. a lot of times they'll say, "Well, in 1974, you said this," and it's like, "Yeah, I was 24 back then. I'm now 60. Can you give me a break?" I mean, taking up for politicians, but I think a lot of times people are expected to be consistent all the time for their whole lives, but really nobody is that way. And so I think it's interesting to see how Lysander kind of became more radicalized over time. I think the Civil War definitely fired him up in a way that he maybe wasn't prior to that.
Yeah, I agree. I think the Civil War moved him into agorism and out of, well, there wasn't a big L libertarian back then, but prior to that, I think he would have been a big L libertarian, and then I think he would have been an agorist after that.
And so by big L libertarian, that means the Libertarian Party?
Yeah, that's like the political part of libertarianism.
Perhaps. I wonder what he would think about the Libertarian Party today. That's another topic. But the agorism thing, I think it's definitely true. And I think he meant it, you know, with the American Letter Mail Company, he meant it to be a statement against the post office. Because, you know, I think he wasn't the only one to be a competitor, but he was the most rebellious, like, I'm purposefully trying to beat you kind of thing. And I think that's why he got the Eye of Sauron right. on him in the way that he did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he made it very clear that his intent for starting that letter company was to show the legal problems of the state having a monopoly. And so that was very libertarian, political libertarian. He wanted to change the laws. Like he was, he was challenging it on the standing of law.
Right.
So he made that very clear. And that was early on in his life, midlife or whatever. And then you get to the point in his life where he's writing a letter to non-slaveholders in the South. And he's basically saying, you know, help the slaves gain their freedom by flogging their masters and taking their property, which, yeah. That sounds pretty agoristic. That was one of my favorite letters of his.
I believe towards the end of it, if I remember, this is just memory paraphrasing, I think he says that if you do not do right by the slave, then you should be killed or you should be hanged or something like that. Like he basically says, like, help them out, but if you screw them over, they should hang you or they should kill you. And I'm just like, I just love how savage
I think he said,
it is.
I think it was flogging. I think he was a big proponent of flogging.
Flogging, yes. It's kind of a funny word we don't use today. But what is that? That means to beat, right? To beat them?
Yeah, like to get whipped. So... But in that letter, he made it really clear. I mean, if we're talking about agorism and the non-aggression principle, he said that slavery was an act of war against the individual. So you were well within your right to use whatever force necessary to get yourself out of slavery. So it was a pretty brutal letter. People should read it. It's not one he's most famous for, obviously, but it's a good one.
Well, of course, he's most famous for No Treason, but I haven't read all of his works, I'm going to be honest. But when you go back and read some of the lesser stuff, I think it's just as scathing in many ways. I know that No Treason is popular because it is such a big sort of magnum opus on a topic that is, you know, more in the forefront. But some of that other stuff, the letters, things like that, are quite savage. I just really love the what's the word, like, super directness that he, it reminds me kind of like the Anti-Federalist Papers a lot, when they sort of just go at the drafters of the Constitution and just sort of call them names, but you know, in that old 19th century and 18th century you know, gentlemanly manner, that where they just like read you to filth, but they do it so eloquently that you can't do anything but laugh at it. You know, I really the articulateness of his critiques, I think, is what makes it so good, because it's like, it to me sometimes it reads as comedy, and comedy really keeps it interesting, you know, because he's so savage. I just love it.
Yeah, he's really comical in how he does it. It's almost kind of like a I can't think of his name, the modern day Chris Hitchens. He's an atheist, and kind of how he talks about religion from his point of view, you know. And of course, I'm not bashing religion.
Sure.
But he was like a iconoclast, you know, in that sense.
Well, the Constitution has become sort of like a religious document, or, you know, at least a...
Oh, without a doubt.
You know what I mean? Like, I find that in today's world, especially among the sort of mainstream Republican or conservative wings of the bird, there is this sort of automatic obsession and reverence for the Constitution, and not much discussion of, like, is this valid? Is this viable? Like, what is this really saying? It's just like, we all love the Constitution. It is our founding document. It is our amazing creation. And I'm just like, you know, have you read it? You know, I think a lot of people haven't read it or haven't thought about it critically. And I think that's, like, why Spooner is so important, because I really don't hear a lot of people in the past or in the present really breaking down the Constitution and addressing this idea of whether it's legitimate or not. It's always a given that it is. Always.
It's a given.
On TV and the media. It's crazy. It's like, we can't take 5 minutes to discuss whether there's a better idea. It's just like, God bless America. I pledge allegiance.
Yeah. And it's almost like to question the document is almost a form of heresy.
Exactly. Because, you know? If you're questioning the document, what is it? That you don't want freedom of speech? You don't want the Second Amendment? Not the stuff that we don't already have. We don't really have it in reality, but it's on paper. You know, but, you know, you either... I think it's that binary thinking of, like, if you don't support it, you must hate everything, every word in it. You must be for the opposite of the Constitution, which I guess they would see as slavery or some horrible dictatorship or something. So I don't really know what the alternative is.
Yeah, I think everything in our society has become that. It almost seems like everything is an either or, you know, kind of question. It seems to me that the majority of people have lost their ability to think things all the way through in kind of a linear progression through logic. And so you end up in this place where, oh, you don't want to wear a mask? You must hate old people.
I know, right?
You must want...
I know, right? It is that way. It's like there's an assumption of the opposite if you disagree with one thing. It's like an assumption that, you know, when I don't wear a mask, you know, and people say stuff to me, you know, there's this assumption that I have negative or evil intent. There's not much questioning of, like, why do you choose this? There's no room for a discussion. And the media is very much playing into that, because you see these segments, they can barely squeeze an interview in because it's like, all right, Senator, gotta go. It's like, okay, we can't take any time to actually dig into the topic. You know, you look at TV from 30 years ago, and there's these, like, I remember looking at all these, like, Thomas Sowell videos and how he and like William F. Buckley Jr. would just sit in front of the camera and have this like long discussion for 45 minutes about issues. And it's like, that doesn't happen anymore in mainstream stuff, maybe in podcasts, but not on mainstream mm-hmm. media.
Right. Yeah. 'Cause the show is 45 minutes long and they've got 35 minutes of commercials. So how else are they going to do it?
Yeah. And that's why I think that format is dying. And I think that, mm-hmm. you know, podcasts like, you know, like Joe Rogan have kind of showed like, okay, well, there's plenty of market for something else. And, you know, hopefully podcasts like yours and videos like mine will get at least a little bit more engagement in that this new kind of media world. But I think that the mainstream media, especially without Trump, is going to be completely ignored, more ignored than they already are. I think CNN only gets watched at airports.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't watch any of those shows anymore.
Well, it's not worth it. There's nothing on there, no. Really.
I wanted to get a highlight reel of the presidential debate, so I think I watched a YouTube clip from one of those channels, you know, CNN or Fox or something, and I could handle like a minute and a half or 2 minutes, and then I just couldn't watch anymore. But
yeah, the debates can be really, they can test your patience, because like when I like to watch the debates, it's like I have this thing about, I love debates and I love pageants, even though I think pageants are often grotesque and horrible. There's something about watching a train wreck that is interesting and exciting. But like, you know, the debates are always crazy because they don't ever really get into any real issue at all. It's like you watch this thing mm-hmm. for 2 hours and it's all surface, you know, 30 seconds to respond. It's like, can you really contextualize something important in 30 seconds? Not really.
Mm. Right. Yeah, it's just, it's part of the theater.
And I think this, you know, bringing it back to agorism, you know, I think that the more people make independent media, it is sort of like a media agorism, I guess you could say. It's like you're creating a market to beat a bigger market, in a sense. You know, maybe mm-hmm. agorism isn't the perfect word to describe it in terms of like podcasters and things like that. But, you know, the underground, I think, ultimately always wins because the above ground always copies the underground. It happens in art. I think it happens in politics too. It's like, it's always people that you don't know are the ones who are more influential than the ones on television, like Lysander Spooner. It's like he's had mm-hmm. a huge impact on a lot of things, but no one knows who he even is except for, you know, yeah. libertarian nerds like ourselves.
Right. Yeah. It really is amazing that no one knows anything about him with everything he contributed. I mean, he's the reason why your mail gets delivered to your house instead of having to go to the mailbox or the post office.
Yeah, I just
learned that. He's the one that forced that innovation. Yeah, which is pretty interesting, you know. And I guess he's kind of known, if you're a stamp collector or something like that, he's kind of known, a lot of people call him the father of the 5-cent stamp or the 3-cent stamp or something like that, because of, you know, because of his competition, the government had to lower rates and find cheaper ways to do things.
But of course, as we know, the government eventually flexed its muscles and basically edged him out of business. And I think what did they mm-hmm. I think what they did was, didn't they tell people that if they used the post office that they would have to give up using American Letter Mail Company? Like they sort of made people choose between one or the other or something. I'm not sure if I remember why, but yeah, they squeezed him out using their power, of course.
Yeah, how they did that was, so mail was carried by railroads in a lot of places, and they would tell the railroads and the other carriers of the mail, I'm talking about the bulk mail, not the delivery people, that if they wanted the United States Postal Service business, they couldn't carry his mail for him. You know, so he would have a hard time getting letters from one state to another state because the railroad wouldn't carry it for him, or they'd lose the U.S. Post Service.
Very interesting. It's kind of ironic that the state sort of used a quasi-market tactic to edge out the market itself. It's kind of,
yeah,
you know, they don't have, there's no strategy that the state won't use to win, even if it's using its opponent's strategy, which I guess is to their mm-hmm. credit to a certain degree. Yes, they were smart enough to do that. Bureaucrats are not known for their high degree of innovation and, and you know, fast thinking and moving, but...
Yeah, but they are known for their muscle.
Oh, yes. Yes, they're very good at killing people and making death machines and things like that. That they do very much excel in that. But when you have a basically unlimited pool of funding and a central bank that's willing to create money from nothing for you to the tune of $28 trillion, of course you can... Of course, incompetent people can figure out how to hire the right people to be competent at what they want to do in that circumstance.
Right.
But I would love to see these people, you know, actually compete. It would be interesting if the government had not edged out the American Letter Mail Company. Like, I wonder if the post office would have survived at all if they had continued to compete on an even playing field. Not that they would, because they're the government. And I believe it's in the Constitution to have the Postal Service. I could be wrong about that, but there's some kind of law or something that established it as like a national necessity or something. I'm not sure if you know.
Yeah, it did establish, it did give Congress the right to establish that service. I don't think it was mandated, but... you know, I'm not really sure about that. That might have came later. I'm going to say I don't know.
It's an odd thing, though. Like, of all industries for the government to be so concerned with being in charge of, you know, I understand police and military and all that. I get why they want that. But mail delivery, it just seems like...
Yeah,
like
it is kind of odd.
They really hold it close. Like, it's this sacred national honor. And I'm just like, it's delivering pieces of paper. I don't see.
Maybe there was something a bit more nefarious in the beginning because that was the form of communication. Maybe it was a way for the government to keep an eye on things, kind of like how they keep an eye on the internet nowadays. Maybe that explains why the head guy in charge is called a general. You know, the Postmaster General. I don't know.
That's a good point. I mean, that I wonder. I'd like to research that and figure out if there's any evidence of why they were so concerned with it. But that could very well be it, because they it's true, they didn't really, you couldn't call anybody, obviously. You couldn't really get across the country very easily, especially if you needed to spy on certain people. Very easy way to intercept communications. There's always some sort of nefarious intent, it seems. People love to talk about how the government is, or the Constitution and all this is this great protector. But when you get down to it, like as Lysander Spooner said, you know, it is either facilitated, you know, the government that we have today, or it has been powerless to stop it. Either way, it is unfit to exist. That is paraphrasing, but
right. Yeah, the last sentence of that one, that was Constitution of No Authority, I think.
Yeah, it's the, I don't have it in front of me, but it's that last line, which I think is so powerful. Just that phrase, unfit to exist. I really like that mm-hmm. term, because it's like, it presents it in a way that it's not that we don't like it. It's that it itself is not worthy of doing the job that it claims to do.
And right.
I think he's been right over time. I mean, even if you think about the 1860s, even then, before the Federal Reserve, before, you know, the surveillance state as we had before all the stuff that we live with today. It's like even he even saw it, saw the problems then, which hardly anybody else did except for the Anti-Federalists, but they had been long dead by, you know, the 1860s.
Yeah, and I haven't read anything that put more clearly the logic of the idea of consent and why it doesn't exist as far as the consent of the governed. Like, he made more sense to me than anything else I've read about the consent of the governed. And I was one of the people, you know, back in the day where it was, well, of course there's consent to the governed. We have the social contract. Like, that made perfect sense to me at one time. And now it is, it makes no sense. Like, I can't even wrap my head around it now.
Right. How could consent literally be defined as the opposite of consent? Meaning, you know, how could there be a contract with no agreement? So therefore, that, like, it undermines the entire definition of a contract. But it people are bewildered a lot of times when you bring it up, because it's just never discussed ever in the public school system, which most people are getting most of this from, that civics, early civics education about, you know, how wonderful the Constitution is and how it protects our freedoms and all of this. No one's exposed to it until they're older, and then you're seen as a conspiracy theorist a lot of times because you're bringing up something that is, like, dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, it really is.
In that Constitution of no authority, the best argument against this idea that there's such a thing as consent to the governed is the Civil War. You know, he was basically saying the Civil War proved that there's no consent, no such thing as this consent of the governed. Because if there was, when almost the entirety of the South decided they didn't want to be governed by the North anymore, they should have let them walk. And they wouldn't. So they're obviously governed by force.
Right. And it's funny because the view of Lincoln today is that he was this amazing hero who kept the Union together, and he was so brave. And obviously none of us like slavery, you know, that was, it's good to end slavery, but, you know, Lincoln wasn't really seen that way in such glowing terms by everybody back then. And if you really look at, you know, from a Spoonerian view, you know, you would see Lincoln as basically a tyrant, not because he, you know, got rid of slavery and we love slavery, but because he chose to fight a war for really no reason. I mean, why did you need to attack the South and burn and rape and pillage? What was the preserving the Union really worth 600,000 deaths? You know, no one talks about, I think Thomas DiLorenzo writes a lot about that, about Lincoln and how, who really was the real Lincoln. And I think it's pretty shocking to hear kind of how kind of authoritarian he really was. I mean, he locked up journalists for being against him, and it was awful. But yet here we are worshiping him.
Yeah, there are a number of biographies about him that do not paint him as the hero that we're taught when we're in grade school. You know, a lot of there are biographies that if you read it and if you believe them to be true, you think, you know, this guy should not be on the $5 bill. Or maybe he should, given what the $5 represents. But anyway, he was not what we were taught. They literally manufactured a hero out of him after the fact.
But isn't that always the case? You know, history is written by the winners. You know, I wonder you know, if the Confederacy had, you know, been able to hold off the North until, let's say, the North and the South had like a, you know, a ceasefire, or, you know, they, let's say they had agreed to separate, you know, without war, or at least not as much war, you know, the South would have probably written about him as being a traitor to freedom or to whatever it is that they believed in. Now, you know, I think slavery would have was on its way out anyway, just as a from a cultural and sociopolitical and technological perspective. I don't think that they would have passed up, you know, the machines of that were coming about that day in, you know, for slaves. I don't think they would have probably ended up, you know, abandoning that strategy, an immoral strategy, obviously. But I certainly don't think that the Civil War had to happen, you know. And I think that Lysander Spooner was one of those people that was both an abolitionist and a secessionist, which most people don't believe can coexist in one person.
Right, but he absolutely was. And he had sound arguments for the reasons why, and they weren't the same as the arguments other people were making at the time. You know, the other abolitionists of the time were arguing that the Constitution supported slavery, and we needed to amend the Constitution. And Spooner was saying that the Constitution did not support slavery. And how can you say the Constitution does support slavery and in the same breath say, I support the Constitution? You can't, that's not a consistent point of view. You know, and not many people were making that argument at the time, that legal type argument.
Well, he was looking at the Constitution in such a... And I guess I would say as objective a legal way as you could, you know, saying what do the words on paper say and what can we like actually logically deduce from these words? Because I believe that the Constitution says something like people bound by labor or labor bounded people or something. I don't know that they explicitly use the word slave, which is kind of problematic because, you know, generations down the road, people could interpret these words to be something really different than what, you know, the quote-unquote founding fathers meant by them, which is clearly why we're here today, because now, you know, you have gun bans and you have all kinds of curtailing of free speech and all the other, simply because they decided to to interpret it differently, you know. And that's the problem with the Constitution is that it's so vague. It's just so vague. You can't tell what the hell it means half the time.
And Spooner's argument was that you can't interpret the document. You have to read the words as they are, and if it's not clear, you have to default to liberty. That was his basic argument. If it's not clear, then liberty wins, whatever it is in that context. And that's what he was talking about, too, with the idea of, you know, people of, I'm with you. I can't remember what the term was, the people bound by labor. You know, his argument was, okay, well, what about children slaves? They're not bound by labor. So he would bring these arguments in to make it a vague meaning and then say, well, it's too vague. We have to err on the side of liberty.
But erring on the side of liberty, I think is, I hate to say it, kind of the weakest part of his argument from other people's perspective, I guess, because that you could say, well, why are you defaulting to liberty? Why is that the default? You know, because a lot of people today don't believe that that is the default, right? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people back in those days felt the same way. I mean, a lot of people wanted George Washington to be the king. They wanted to replace an old monarchy with a new one. You know, this idea that everyone was all, you know, in favor of the Revolutionary War and creating this wonderful constitutional republic is kind of a myth. I mean, it was a small minority of mainly the power brokers and aristocracy that really put this whole thing into motion, and everybody else just ended up going along with the ride, like every other revolution seems to happen. So, you know, it's interesting how that all plays out.
And they weren't, you know, and it's not like they were really given a choice anyway. When they say in the Declaration of Independence, by the consent of the people, that's, they were talking about the consent of the very small colonial aristocracy. They weren't talking right. about the consent of the population, because most people, they didn't give most people a say. First of all, you had, if I'm remembering right, you had to be a landowner to even get a say. So, you know, that excluded all black people, Indians, women, children, a lot of people who didn't get a say in that.
And I think that's like the one thing that I guess the left wing anarchists, what if you want to use that term, kind of get right, is this is a lot of economically, I'm very far away from a lot of people on that side of things, but I think the acknowledgement that like this we the people idea never meant more than a very small majority of people, and yes, it did exclude, you know, women and other races and all this kind of thing, which sounds kind of like a woke thing to talk about, but it's true. I mean, it was that way. So who really is the people? You know, which people? I wasn't alive then, so I certainly didn't sign anything and certainly didn't agree to it, yet I'm part of the people, and I'm supposed to love it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very strange... And it comes from public schools and the Pledge of Allegiance and all of that kind of stuff. I think it gets burned into your psyche very young.
Yeah, it is so tightly ingrained at such a young age that when you hear something to the contrary as an adult, it just creates a cognitive dissonance. Like, you just can't... Like, the first time I heard someone talk like this, I didn't get it. You know? I didn't just hear this for the first time and go, holy crap, you're right, I'm an anarchist. I had to hear these kinds of things over and over and over, and it was a long journey that moved me to where I am today, you know?
Yeah, it's true. I think we can, all of us who are, you know, on the, I guess, the anarchist spectrum, there was like a before time and then an after time, and a lot, I think everybody has their own, for lack of a better term, sort of come to Jesus moment where you're like, okay, I get, now I understand why they talk like this. It doesn't sound as radical now because there's a context of logic and analysis that whether mm-hmm. you agree with it or not, you can at least understand it. And when you get down to it, libertarianism is very simple. And I think that's kind of its biggest asset, but also its biggest downfall in the eyes of the public, is that people imagine that political issues have to be, you know, complex, and the experts have to, you know, weigh in on this, and you know, it's very solemn, and we must, you know, discuss the issue. And it's like, no, freedom's the answer, because I am a free human being. It's like, that sounds utopian to some people, and it sounds too good to be true, because it couldn't be that simple. But in many ways, it really
is. Yeah, there are just some few basic, I guess they call them first principles, that you start with, and you go, everything spreads out from there. You know, you start with self-ownership on one hand and non-aggression on the other hand, and you can get to every decision from those two points.
Right, and I think it's NAP can be a little controversial, because there are fairly good arguments that the NAP is not 100% sufficient, but I think those are mostly, you know, marginal cases. I think in general you can, you know, even the average person without having knowledge of all of this stuff has an internal sense of libertarian ethics on an individual basis. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's when people get into groups and when they start identifying with the nation and the state and the county and the whatever it is, that they lose that sense, because it's like there's... You know, people talk about the ethics of individualism, which is what I talk a lot about, are well accepted. But when you talk about the government, people don't think that is related. You know, I can't right. steal from you, but somehow the government can. And that's not seen as a contradiction in terms, because it's not stealing, it's taxes.
Right. And that goes back to kind of what you said earlier about it being a religion, and Larkin Rose talks about it in his book, The World's Most Dangerous Superstition, the reason we do that is because we believe the government is above us. There's this special thing called government that has powers that normal humans don't have.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and that comes, I think, originally from the monarchy. I think it's that idea mm-hmm. of the unit, this higher authority that is almost granted from God, which in the king's case, or the queen, yeah, that's exactly what they did say. I think that's how they held their power, because of that partnership between the crown and the cross, in a sense. It's like mm-hmm. the crown's like, you got my back, I'll protect you if you protect me. And the crown, you know,
right.
the clergy's like, all right, I'll make sure that they worship you like they worship us, and we'll make some money on the side. You know, it's really, it is a kind of gangster situation. Now, I mean, if you're religious, that's one thing. I'm not particularly talking about whether there is a God or not. That's kind of a bigger topic beyond anyone's ability to say 100%, I think. But the institutions of religion have clearly been used to further the state, and the state has clearly used, you know, the clergy and all of that to do the same thing. So, you know, we're an outgrowth of the monarchy. I mean, it's just, I think I said this in one of my videos, is that the Constitution is the new king. They just replaced a king with a document that now has 100 heads of the snake versus one. And you can't kill a 100-headed snake or a 538-headed snake that easily. Mm-hmm. And it's like kind of insidious. It's like, yes, they gave us some rights, I guess, to a certain degree, but now, how do you ever redress these grievances? How do you ever get rid of it and replace it with something else when that's considered insurrection and treason? You've built a new impenetrable fortress.
Right. And the only place you can go to address those grievances is the people who are responsible for the grievance. You know, the courts are just part of the government. So where do you go? And I think also in that same vein of thought, that the clergy has been replaced by academia.
Oh, yes.
And it's academia's job to make sure everybody believes in this thing called government. And if they do it correctly, government will make sure there are always plenty of grants to go around and, you know, money for the institution.
Well, I've spent far more time than I ever wish I had in the higher education sphere, in academia, and it's amazing what the people in academia are putting out there as far as their political views. And I would agree with you, it is very much a partnership now. Academia is the new clergy in that way, because I remember I walked into grad school, and of course, you know, I own a dance studio by my profession. So I was there for, you know, dance training and arts and things like that. And the first day we were talking about how horrible capitalism was, you know, it was like blatant, right. Like capitalism is the reason for all the problems. And it was like not even put in any more nuanced terms than that. And so how do we solve capitalism? The government somehow, you know,
right.
And it's amazing. But, you know, the ironic part of that is that, you know, the government is what kept slavery around longer than it probably otherwise would have. The government is what kept made Jim Crow laws. And yet now we're going to try to use the government to end racism, when the legacy mm-hmm. of all of this was set in stone by those same organizations. I often get myself confused. I don't know who's where anything is anymore.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, you had said earlier that that you thought that slavery was kind of on its way out, which I agree with. And And now we're talking about government solving the problem of capitalism, and government is really the thing that has inhibited capitalism. And then you go back to slavery and you can connect the dots, because the Underground Railroad was illegal. That was held up by government. Those laws, it was the government that was saying, if a runaway slave makes it to your house, you're a criminal if you don't turn them in.
It's crazy.
I agree with you. It was the government was the reason why slavery was still hanging on.
And people today, you know, still look to government to solve social problems, mm-hmm. which you would think that they would know from experience, witnessing that the government can't solve social problems. You know, whenever they try to, they end up creating 10 other problems, which of course then need 10 new bills and more stimulus and more this and more that.
Right.
Because, you know,
right.
it's like that scene from Fantasia, the Disney movie, where like the broom breaks in half and then it becomes two brooms, and then those two brooms break in half. You know, it just multiplies. And I think that's a lot of what I think the anti-federalist and also Spooner were kind of afraid of, is that this thing is going to metastasize into a monster. It's going to grow, you know, just like, well, I think it was it Benjamin Franklin who said something like, you know, it's a republic if you can keep it.
If
and I would argue
it,
we haven't kept it. I don't think it ever really functioned at all the way that they said it did. You know, you read the Constitution and it does not comport with everyday life. You know, all men are created equal and all this. It's like, except for blacks and except for, you know.
Right. Well, my position on that is they weren't saying all men are created equal in the sense that we view it today. They were
right.
saying something completely different. You know, they were saying to the king, hey, you and I are the same. You don't get to just say you're the boss. You know, you only get to say you're the boss if we agree that you can be the boss. Otherwise, we're equal. You know,
right.
And which is not to say the same thing that we believe today, that, you know, the abolition and all of those steps. And what's interesting too is in that same part, King George responded to the Declaration and was saying, you know, I was born with this right. I was born with this obligation to rule you, and you were born with the obligation to be a subject. And in my mind, there's not much difference between that and saying, you've given your consent because you were born in this territory. You were obligated by birth to consent to this government, which is the social contract. But to me, those two statements are nearly the same. You were born to be a subject, and I was born to be a king, and you were born in this territorial jurisdiction, and therefore you must consent to our rule. They're the same thing in my mind.
That's a really good point. It is the logic of it. Yes, it's different. That is talking about different, I guess, things, but it's the exact same logic. You know, that's an interesting irony with the, you know, the quote founding fathers. I always like to say quote on that because I don't love using that term unironically or without a little bit of snarkiness, but. You know, it is interesting.
I agree with you completely, but it used to tear me up. You know, somebody said founding fathers, and I'd get a little teary-eyed. I was such a patriot.
Yeah, it is interesting how they didn't see the problem with the logic of it. They took the same concept. It's almost like they wanted to be the king in a sense, or create the new kingship in the image that they would like to be ruled. You know, they weren't really fighting for liberty. You know, it's like they, mm-hmm. you know, if they had just talked a good game and said, You know, we are independent. We don't acknowledge your kingship anymore. And we're going to go do our own thing. And that be it. Now, we did have the Articles of Confederation, which, you know, did not grant enough power to the people who overthrew the crown. And so they were kind of like, hey, we don't, at least this is my interpretation. They're kind of like, hey, we don't have enough. We don't have a strong enough nation. We need to build a big ass country that can, you know, rival. It's like they got a taste of power from the revolution, and I just don't think they had the spiritual wherewithal to walk away, to throw the ring into the fire, so to say. They
right.
It was right. Too tempting, and I think that yes, it was an improvement, I guess, in some ways, but. You know, I always like to think about, you know, how, you know, could George III have ever had the amount of control over people that the current U.S. government has over Americans? You know, technologically, all that stuff aside, you know, the colonists revolted over several things, but part of it was like tea taxes. You know, it was small things in comparison to what we're dealing with now. It's like we have 35% income taxes on certain levels and all this stuff. And I'm like, you revolted over like 2 shillings. Like, and here we are.
Yeah, it was like 0.5%. It was like not half a, it was one cent, or I don't remember what it was, but it was minuscule. And they were like, oh, hell no. You know, yes. And like you said, now we're giving away half our paycheck. When you count every kind of tax.
Yeah, it's amazing how different it really is from, you know, if you read the Constitution, like if you were an alien and you came down from wherever you're from and you read the Constitution and it, without having any knowledge of how the real world is working, I don't think that they would imagine our society to be operating nearly the way that it does. You know, so the Constitution has become sort of a ceremonial, traditional kind of document in the way that the Queen of England has kind of become a ceremonial figure. She doesn't really have political power in the way that the right. Crown used to have, but it still occupies this legitimate place in society. It's like it's a wink and a nod. It's like I control the government. I the Queen have. You know, own the government, but I just wink and nod and agree to not use that power. You know, therefore, you will hold me up as the sovereign, and we get to keep our family money and our family stuff, and you just run the government for me. You know, which is kind of a good deal when you think about it. I mean, the kings have always been bad at running the government. It's almost like they're like, hey, right. So I can keep all the glory and all the pomp and circumstance and all this wonderful, you know, gaudy crap that I've you know, that glorifies me, but I don't have to do any work. Amazing.
Right.
You know, so yeah. Who really won out in
Wait a
the
minute.
British situation?
But I get to keep all the dresses and still go to the balls, but I don't have to worry about this crap? Yeah, not a bad gig.
Yeah, so, you know, the parliament gets to think that it's, like, won this democratic, you know, whole thing of, like, yes, the people now represent, whereas the king and the queen are just like, oh, great, I get to get off scot-free. Like, I win again.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I have oftentimes thought that the American Revolution was really just a rebranding of a ruling class.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's not an original thought. I've heard that from lots of people. But it was just kind of like you were talking about earlier, how you know, the monarch was replaced by the Constitution, and then the clergy was replaced by academia. It was just a rebranding. It was easier to sell.
Yeah, I feel like that happens a lot. I mean, the Soviet Union, I think, is a similar kind of example. Yes, communism kind of fell. The Soviet Union lost some of its, you know, control and territory, but the power structures that were already at play kind of persisted. I mean, Vladimir Putin was part of the KGB, and now he's, you know what I mean? It's like the structures, you know, they just sort of rearrange to where the public will tolerate it. They're just trying to brand themselves, just like you just said, in a way that doesn't cause revolution. It's like they'll the People's Republic of China. It's not the people's, and it's not a republic by any sense, mm-hmm. any sense of the word, but it serves the purpose. And, you know, they have clearly made it work for, you know, it's horrible over there. We could that could be a whole episode on its own, how terrible China treats itself and its own people or whatever. But, you know, it is that way. Cuba, you know, was another revolution. I think that was a different situation. But even the revolutionaries tend to become what they've replaced. When people get power, they right. can't resist it. Because if I'm in power, there's no way I would do anything bad because I'm a good person, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that even, you know, I try to have the wisdom to know that if I were in power, if you gave me that ultimate authority, you know, the country and the world is too complex for any human not to screw it up. So I would probably end up screwing it up too. I would probably end up being totalitarian without realizing it, you know, because I unintended consequences.
Right. And the idea that I'm a good person is the reason why, because we don't all value the same things. We all think we're good people, but we all have different values. So for example, for somebody who is a pro-lifer, you know, now they're a dictator and I'm a good person and I love babies, therefore nobody can have an abortion. Well, that's going to be a completely different thing than somebody who is on the other side of that argument, who says, I'm a good person because I believe a woman should be able to control her own body. And so, you know what I mean? Like, everyone would do that because they think they're a good person. And they would try to force the values that they think are good onto other people. And it would be the same thing we've got today.
Sure. Even Hitler thought he was doing what was good and right and prudent for the German people. But clearly mm-hmm. we know that it was not right for anybody because it's mass murder. But, you know, I can't remember who said this, but I remember a quote from a long time ago. It was like, is it men, in order to do evil, must first believe that what they are doing is good. I mean, unless, of course, you're a psychopath, in which case they will do evil things knowing that it's evil simply because they don't care and don't have a sense of empathy. But, you know, that's that horrible mm-hmm. paradox of, like, you know, some of the people who are the most well-intentioned end up doing the most damage. You know?
Yeah, and we're all susceptible to that.
Sure.
You know, it takes... I mean, I've done it. I've done things that I look back on now thinking, you know, I really thought I was doing the right thing. Hindsight showed me I should have minded my own business, you know. But
yeah. Well, none of us are perfect.
Sure. Yeah, we're all at fault in that area. But the idea that I own myself and I don't own you and I don't have the right to initiate violence against you solves almost all of those problems.
Yes, if you have a solid definition of those terms, which I think is part of the miscommunication with I guess statists or whatever, you know, I don't mean to cast disparagement upon anybody who isn't a libertarian, because not everybody's always in the same place in their life, but mm-hmm. you know, definitions of terms is often where things go wrong. Even if you're debating, like, I debate a lot of, like, used to, communists on the internet, and you can't
That's
argue
hard.
With them. Yeah, it is. That's why I quit. You can't argue with yeah. them because they have very different definitions of the same words that you are using as arguments against their position. And so when you can't agree on what the word democracy means or what the government means or what any of the, then you can't have a discussion. And with the average person, these words have certain meanings and contexts that I think libertarians are often not using because of a, I guess, a different framework of understanding. And that causes a lot of those misunderstandings. That's why it's like when you have debates, you know, it's important to be like, okay, we're debating the public education system or something. Let's talk, let's define what public education means so we can actually argue this. But that doesn't happen a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and the big one in that realm is capitalism.
Oh, God.
And then I would say private property probably falls next in the phrases and words that cause most confusion when people are debating. And, you know, you and I are in the groups on MeWe quite a bit, and a lot of times I will catch myself saying a few things and then say something, and I think I've seen you do it too, say, well, I'm just splitting hairs here, but really, which is true, you're just splitting hairs, but you're also trying to narrow down what is it we're talking about exactly, right?
Right.
What is the definition of what it is we're talking about? Because without it, you're right, there's just too much confusion.
Well, I think I remember that post was really talking about, I think, the definition of maybe anarchy or something, where some people say it's no hierarchies of any kind versus no rulers. And those are very different ideas and lead to some very different conclusions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people just can't bridge that gap between those two things. And it applies to other things as well.
Yeah, I think that this pushback so hard against hierarchy, that seems like a new thing to me. I don't know where that has come from.
Well, a lot of that comes from the 19th century anarcho-communist writers, kind of like Proudhon and Kropotkin and Bakunin, yeah, and all of those kinds of people. Like, I read, I think it was called Property. What was it? I forget. But where Proudhon says that, you know, property is theft, and you go through this whole thing. And it's funny because I think a lot of those people don't read their own texts, because even when you get into a lot of those writers, they're defining the words in ways that I think are actually a little more friendly to the libertarian side than the left would like to admit. You know, I think they cling to certain concepts, but when you actually read it, it's a little more nuanced, and it's not quite as like black flag anarchist as they would like to believe.
Yeah, I've tried a number of times to read some of the communist writings, and it's so difficult for me. Like, I don't know if it's just, I think we all have, our brains are to a certain degree, I don't want to say predetermined or predestined, but we have this certain predilection. That's not even a word, is it? We're going to lean one way. We're going to lean towards this thing or that thing. And I think maybe a lot of it just has to do with how our brain is structured individually and the path, all the steps we've taken in our lives and the experiences we've had with other individuals. And I think part of that in me is when I read, like, Marx, I can't make sense of it. It just seems so, like, it's just very difficult for me to understand I don't know what it is I'm trying to say. It's very convoluted. I can't,
yeah.
The pieces don't fit together right for me in my head. And so I usually give up reading them.
It's really overcomplicated. And I think that's part of the allure of it. I think a lot of people who really want to be smart and want to be super a titan of the intellect will find the most convoluted, complicated thing and then pretend to understand it to show a sense of intellectual superiority over others. I think that happens a lot. With Marx especially, because, like, well, Marxism, if you really read Marx, and, like, okay, have you read all three volumes of Das Kapital? I really don't think you have, because that stuff, it's going to drive you insane. Because he's, you know, when you write an entire body of work on false assumptions, you can really go down some weird rabbit holes, and people really just like to sound smart a lot of times, and they will overly complicate their words and overly you know, it's almost like they don't want you to understand it, because if you don't understand it, you can't argue against it. But if you don't understand it, it makes me seem like I'm smarter, so therefore I win.
Yeah, well, that could be it. All I know is I couldn't finish reading it.
I don't blame you.
But I will say, I haven't read it. I couldn't read it. It didn't make sense to me. I'm certainly not going to pretend that it made sense.
Well, we can stick with Spooner. It's a lot more cohesive. You can actually understand it. It's written in real language that human beings can decipher pretty easily, and I think that's kind of to its credit. I think a lot of libertarian texts are written this way, unless you're getting into, you know, the privatization of roads and highways, when you get into some really, like, you know, nitty gritty stuff. But, you know, overall, it's a simple idea, and simple ideas don't need, you know, incredibly arcane explanations.
Right.
And
he's witty and funny, like I said earlier, too. And I like specifically how he compares the government to the highwayman. And that's also a constitution of no authority, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And he's basically saying the highwayman wouldn't do all these other things to you that the government does. And then at the end, he says the highwayman, he's too much of a gentleman, which I thought was really funny. But yeah, I agree with you. He is much easier to understand.
You know, and Marx was, you know, not to go too deep into him, but, you know, Marx was really the kind of person who had the time to sit around and overly pontificate on things to an absurd extent. You know, he was pretty much the Bernie Sanders of the 19th century, in the sense that he really didn't produce much other than writing, and he kind of lived on other people's dime, and he came from a rich family. You know, he kind of fits the bill for your average sort of Antifa style person who, you know, a lot of times they do come from upper middle class, upper class families, and they become a bit resentful of their own lot in life. A lot of people have been doing some exposés on people like that, and I don't mean to you know, judge everybody. I mean, everybody's got their own thing, and none of us are perfect, and we all go through our journey. We're not all born libertarian, and we're not all going to die libertarian, but you know, Marx was a bit of a trust fund kind of kid, if you get my drift.
Yeah. Well, I think I have to disagree with you a little bit. I think we are all born libertarians. It's just beat out of us. It's just
okay,
smothered
give you,
out of
I
us.
I can give you that. I'll give you that.
Anyway, we're running up on an hour, I think.
Yep, so, hour and seven.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's really longer than I wanted to go, but that was a pretty good conversation. I enjoyed it. I appreciate it.
Hey, no problem.
And
too.
Again, I wanted to, I want to mention your YouTube channel. For the listeners, there's some great stuff over there. Go over there and check it out. Subscribe. He's putting out stuff pretty often. So,
thank you.
Yeah, that's I've really enjoyed what you've been putting out.
And I appreciate you for having me on.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to. All right, well, let's call it a wrap, and maybe we can do this again sometime.
All righty.
All right, thanks.
No problem. I'll see you later.
Here's a little teaser for what's coming next week.
Dimension that comes into everybody's phones, and so it starts to swirl. and all of these ideas start to swirl, and then people kind of feed into these ideas and they gain momentum to where now people are in almost a hysteria that this is going to go down.
Thanks for listening to the Off-Grid Outpost podcast. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to subscribe so you can get all the new episodes.